Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And hello to everyone out there. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, welcoming you to an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, and healthcare and science in the news. We'll be answering some emails, but I want to also invite your calls. And you can reach us at 479-1080 with your questions. You can also email us at the website www.askdrdawn.com. Just hit on the contact us and you'll get a nice little box to fill in. And we have some people who did that and they'll be coming up in just a moment. Let's talk a little bit about vitamin D. Now, a long time ago, back in 1848, before vitamin D was even discovered, researchers at the Hospital for Consumption and Diseases of the Chest, that is to say a TB hospital in London, they had over 1,000 people with tuberculosis to care for. And they had no effective treatment, plus they were in London at the height of the Industrial Revolution, so it was very cloudy and foggy. And the children, well, there were epidemics of rickets in the poor areas because the kids literally never had the sun shine on their bodies. So vitamin D deficiency was just rampant in London. The researchers didn't know that, but they decided to give a spoonful of cod liver oil 3 times a day to half of the tuberculosis patients, and of those who received the cod liver oil, 19% of them died, compared to a third of the control group. And this may be, in fact, the first placebo-controlled trial. Certainly 1848 puts it in the running. Well, by the mid-20th century, we had antibiotics for TB, but in that 100 years between 1848 the therapies were largely taking people out into the sun, bringing them up to the mountains, to places where there was more sunshine, and also sometimes giving them cod liver oil. It wasn't until 1922 that vitamin D was actually identified. Now, in the United States, we get some of our vitamin D from fortified food, particularly dairy. We get some of it from fish and mushrooms, but vitamin D deficiency, if you use 20 as a cutoff, which I personally think is too low, is really fairly epidemic in the population because, well, most of us work indoors nowadays. So we understand that maybe more vitamin D is good, and I'm certainly an advocate of that, but we haven't done the heavy lifting of the science to prove that we need to prove how much it's necessary. And of course, people are always skeptical in medicine until such time as those studies come out. Now, a recent study done in 2010 in Japan found that children taking vitamin D supplementation were less likely to suffer from influenza. This is really important because we're heading into flu season soon, and just about that time that we go into daylight savings time, out of daylight savings time, and of course that means it gets, well, we're in the dark more, and that makes a big difference. Another study showed that just fortifying milk with vitamin D cut the risk of catching a cold in half in a different group of children. There's also a lot of literature, epidemiologic, and I'll explain the shortcomings of that in a second, that show that there are decreased rates of diabetes and cancer and cardiovascular disease in people with higher vitamin D levels. So if that's true, and if we extrapolate from studies on cancer and just breast cancer and colon cancer, if we were to increase the risk, the rate of vitamin D sufficiency in the population, we might eliminate as many as 100,000 cases of cancer in the United States every single year. And wouldn't that be amazing? So there's good data that we should be taking enough vitamin D. And what's a good level? I recommend getting your level between 30 and 60. Your doctor can check the blood level, and that's really probably where we want to keep it. There are some people who take it even higher. There's an activist, Michael Hollick, who shoots for 100 to 150 for his blood level. And in fact, it is true that if you go down and to the equator and you look at hunter-gatherers who are not using sunscreen like the Maasai of Africa, they have a mean serum concentration of about 115. So if you have levels in the above 100 range, people in this country get nervous. But actually, that's just because the studies haven't come in yet and medicine is innately conservative. And I just want to go to our first email. And this was from Rebecca in Monterey, who wrote in just a couple of days ago about a case of diarrhea in a friend of hers. My friend Joy is 88, has had diarrhea for 5 days. Please just give me a strategy for helping her. I believe she's getting the wrong advice from an outside source. Joy has been eating only eggs for protein and drinking Canada Dry ginger ale, of course, filled with high fructose corn syrup. I'll pick up some electrolyte water today for her and try to ask someone at Whole Foods for some advice. I await your advice as you are the person I trust. Well, Rebecca, here's Dr. Don's take on management of diarrhea in the elderly. First of all, diarrhea can come from many causes. Elderly people are very likely to get it from viral infections. They're more subject to that. Don't fight it off as well. So one of the things that I use to manage the diarrhea itself is high-dose probiotics. Now, you don't want to take those at the same time that you take Pepto-Bismol, although I think Pepto-Bismol is good for managing diarrhea. And I also use a lot of the over-the-counter medication Imodium. These shouldn't be used if the person has a fever with their diarrhea, because then you really need to get a stool culture and make sure that this isn't a pathogenic form of E. coli or Shigella or one of the other bacterial diarrheas, in which case you kind of don't want to stop the diarrhea because that increases the risk that the bacteria could get into your bloodstream. So I use high-dose probiotics for diarrhea. And when I say high-dose, I'm talking about maybe 100 to 200 billion colony-forming organisms, 3 to 5 times a day. And this will often calm down the gut and really mitigate the diarrhea. A person who's not eating enough, which is often the advice they get, drink fluids and don't eat, that's bad advice. You want to be eating, and you particularly want to be getting some fiber. I like blending oat bran into either oatmeal, mashed bananas, or warm applesauce. These are all very easily digested compounds, and that extra fiber helps both feed the good bacteria, but it also helps give you something to form stool around. Now, for protein, I'm particularly fond of bone broth, especially made with chicken, but you can also use turkey or bone broth with beef or pork is fine. And this is available commercially at the health food stores, or you can also just make it yourself, and there are many recipes, strategies on the internet for this. One of the things that bone broth does is it helps soothe the gut lining and also helps rebuild it, because after and during a viral infection, you suffer injury and inflammation in the intestines. Not only are you not able to absorb things as easily, but you also are more likely to develop food sensitivities and be unable to digest starches, certain kinds of starches, in particular milk sugar. So I generally tell people, especially if they're older, even if they normally tolerate milk, no cream, no cheese, and maybe even not any milk yogurt until you were, and then very carefully, because you may find that it gives you back the diarrhea. And by the way, the clue is, if there's gas with that diarrhea, it's probably from malabsorption rather than from a viral infection. yes, electrolytes are important, but I've had some people get into trouble, especially when it's hot, because they're drinking only electrolytes, but they're sweating. And so you can actually end up getting yourself too much sodium and too much potassium if all you're consuming is electrolyte drinks. So yes, you want to replace your electrolytes, but it's more important when you're vomiting. Then you really want to use that Pedialyte or oral rehydration formula. For adults and even for elders, a little bit of that, say a liter a day, but you also want to get some free water. And I generally recommend every time you have a diarrheal stool, 8 ounces of free water, and yes, go ahead and have some electrolyte formula, but be sure, particularly when it's warm, that you don't get too many electrolytes in there. I've also seen this happen, by the way, to runners and people who should, presumably they're losing a lot of free water as they sweat and exercise, but they're replacing with electrolytes and they actually get a little too high in their sodium and potassium. Our next email is from, let me get the page turned here, Karen in Carmel. Karen writes, alternatives to colonoscopy. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I'm in my late 50s and have not yet had a colonoscopy. It's not that I'm fearful of this procedure. I just don't want to do anything invasive if it's not absolutely necessary. There's also no history of colon cancer in my family, yet I would still like to do a screening test. I have a couple of questions. Does a colonoscopy negatively affect your microbiome? And number two, my other alternative for preventative screening is the FIT, which is the fecal immunoglobulin test, folks, annually. What are your thoughts on the Cologuard test that I've recently seen advertised? Is it more accurate than the FIT? Thank you for your input and all that you do for the community. Well, let's start off with the first question. Does getting a colonoscopy negatively affect your microbiome? And the answer to that is, if your microbiome is healthy, not substantially and not for long. People who have a tenuous microbiome, or maybe they have an infestation of some less than desirable bacteria, may find that they get more perturbation by the compounds that we take that basically clean out the gut. We deliberately give you effectively a non-absorbable salt solution. Polyethylene glycol sometimes is also in there. And what we're doing is letting you pull fluid from your bloodstream into the gut and then not letting it back out again. And so that gives you the runs. Kind of almost in a similar way that cholera causes diarrhea. Of course, we're just giving you a temporary case of cholera until you're pooping clear, and then you can stop drinking the PrEP. Most of us, and particularly if you still have an appendix, will regenerate your flora just fine. So that's not something you need to worry about. But I do recommend that if you aren't finding yourself back to normal within 3 or 4 days, that you go and get some fermented food, like some sauerkraut or some yogurt if you tolerate dairy, and maybe take some extra jicama or some extra kiwis. These are both good sources of the type of prebiotic bacteria chow that we want to use to help reestablish your own healthy microbiome. Now on to your second question, Karen. Cologuard is a test that I was very glad to see when it came out. Must have been almost 10 years ago now. But it's had a very, very hard time getting traction. And that's because of where the manufacturers priced it. It's priced at about $600 a test. And that's in comparison to a colonoscopy, which if a person shops around and is paying out of pocket, they can generally get for around $775 or $800 in our local Santa Cruz Monterey community. Let me emphasize, if you do have to buy your own colonoscopy, you talk to the office manager and you negotiate a price, because they'll make a deal. They won't advertise that fact. They can't, but they will. And so you can get a break if you're willing to pay up front. So just a little bit of bargaining, always worth asking for a cash discount when you're buying a procedure out of pocket, like you've got a high deductible or something like that. What the Cologuard does is it looks at a stool specimen and it looks for the hemoglobin, so it's like a FIT test in that respect, but it also looks for mutated DNA, particularly the KRAS mutation, K-R-A-S. If you look that one up on Wikipedia, you'll learn that it's common in a lot of different types of cancers, but colon cancer in particular. So if you see that mutation, you're worried that you have cancer cells coming out in that poop. The other things that they look at are hypermethylated promoter regions, and there's two in particular that Cologuard targets, one called the promoter NDR6G4, and the other called bone morphogenic protein number 3, or BMP3. And these are areas that are turned on by the methyl groups being put on the DNA. And you can screen for a methyl group on this particular stretch of DNA. And if it's there, then you will get a positive on this test. That would indicate that cells are inappropriately dividing, dividing too fast, probably dividing inappropriately, not paying attention to, hey, whoa there, signals from the surrounding cells. And that, by the way, defines cancer behavior. So what happens if you have a positive $600 Cologuard test? Well, then you need a colonoscopy. So studies have been done trying to decide, is this actually a reasonable thing for us to be doing? Should we be testing with the Cologuard and following up with colonoscopy on the positives? How much would that save us and how much would it cost to save a year of life? And they use this indicator called quality adjusted life years for this types of screening. And what we find is that with the Cologuard, with a follow-up colonoscopy, is about a wash with doing colonoscopy every 10 years on all eligible people. It is a little bit better than mammograms in terms of the number of quality, what the cost is for a good year of life saved. An interesting kind of John Stuart Mill way of looking at screening, but the sort of things that governments and insurance companies look at when they decide whether they're going to cover something is, well, exactly how much is this year of life costing us? And by the way, $11,000 is considered a pretty good price point. So if you have one of those high deductibles, then you might be a good candidate. I want to suggest that you shop around for that. You may be able to find that test a little bit cheaper, particularly if you're paying out of pocket. Remember, it never hurts to try and make a deal in this quote-unquote market-based economy of ours. And welcome back. The numbers to call, 479-1080. And I'd love to talk with you. Right now we're talking to Richard in Felton. Hello, Richard, and welcome to the show.
Hi, I was just wondering, watching the progression of the Zika virus and the lack of CDC funding, I was just wondering, where do you see the progression of this virus? I think it's having profound effects, and I was just wondering also specifically whether you could reflect on its effects on like Epstein-Barr virus.
Epstein-Barr virus, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, these are very, very different species of viruses. So the flaviviruses, which these are your yellow fever, these are the ones that are transmitted by mosquitoes. So you've got dengue, you've got yellow fever, you've got Zika, and these viruses have very, very similar surface antigens, which is causing a big problem for us because we don't really have good testing even for Zika. It's so new, and there's a lot of cross-reactivity. So when we test and we get a positive, if someone's been down in South America for a while, we could be getting a cross-reactivity with dengue. Now, there are some RNA tests which just look at RNA for Zika. Those are very, very accurate. But the problem is you have to get the test while there's RNA in the bloodstream, and that's a very short time window. So we're still struggling to actually get a decent Zika test. Now, the virus itself is a neurotropic virus, so it goes to the nerves. Another example of that, a different family of viruses, a different variety, would be chickenpox virus, which also lives in the nerves and can hibernate in the nerves for 10 years and then come back. And I'm sure you've heard of Ebola. That was the big news last year. And Ebola can hibernate in the body. In fact, it turns out that even though it leaves the bloodstream, it hangs around in odd places like the eyeball and the spleen. And we've had a couple of recurrences or recrudescences in some of those healthcare workers who got Ebola and had to be evacuated out last year. So coming around to Zika, this is just so many questions. Now, we've linked it to Guillain-Barré, which is a syndrome that can happen with a lot of different viruses, where neurotropic viruses, that is, where the immune system now attacks the nervous system itself. So it's like the virus got the immune system to make a case of mistaken identity and now attacks itself. In Guillain-Barré, it attacks the spinal column, and you become paralyzed, and it's a progressive weakness from the toes up, which medically is kind of useful because the diseases that come from the toes up tend to be neurologic, and the diseases that start at the core muscles tend to be degenerative, like muscular dystrophy and things like that. So we get a little bit of help in the early stages when we're trying to diagnose this. The thing about the babies is just nuts, and the fact that we've established that Zika can remain in sperm for a very long time, so after it's left the bloodstream, it can stay in sperm, we think up to 6 months. That's been the longest case so far, but that's subject to change as soon as someone finds it in somebody a year after they had Zika. But that means we don't really know when it's really safe. We are using the figure 6 months and, you know, doubling the 3 months where we found it, but maybe it's a year and we just don't know. And we don't have a good test for screening sperm to be sure that we can clear someone if they're seeking pregnancy. We also don't even know whether the mother getting infected during pregnancy will do it. We think so, but it's hard to say where that infection in the women came from. We also don't know exactly where in the pregnancy you have to, you become safe, where you're no longer going to get a damaged baby. But certainly the microcephaly, the small brains, those babies, it has to be hitting fairly early in development to be affecting that, we think. And again, we're not even sure if we can for sure screen the pregnancies and identify the babies with microcephaly in time. So many unanswered questions. And the idea that we are not going to throw a ton of money at this immediately to try and do mosquito control, to try to get testing, to figure out a vaccine would be very, very nice. But once a thing like this gets a foothold in a population, it's much more difficult to eradicate. And right now, we have this really rare window of opportunity where we have a heads up that this is coming and we have strategies. And the fact that this is not being funded, to me, is one of the great failures of America in the 21st century. And I mean, we've already had a few little missteps, shall we say, but this one is one that's going to recoil on us and recoil on our population and provide us with a great many disabled, dysfunctional, but viable children who will require very, very high investment of medical and social services for the rest of their lives. And this is a preventable circumstance that we're not preventing due to political grandstanding. It's truly shameful.
What about an incapacitating agent as genetically engineered like Epstein-Barr virus?
Okay, so Epstein-Barr virus is a naturally occurring virus. It actually came out of Africa, again, where it's seen primarily in children who get something called Burkitt's lymphoma. And in adults or older people, it causes mononucleosis. And there was for a time a real concern that it was the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome. That turned out to be due to a misunderstanding of how chronic fatigue syndrome works. It turns out that there's four or five viruses which, if you've ever been exposed to them, when you get chronic fatigue, you'll develop high antibody titers to these viruses because your immune system is being inappropriately stimulated and the memory cells get stimulated and it looks like you've gotten re-exposed. But actually, they've been able to show that this is a characteristic of the disease. Chronic fatigue syndrome is really not one thing. It's probably caused by a number of different things, but I don't think Epstein-Barr virus is the sole or even for sure one of the causes. Go ahead. What's your opinion?
Yeah, if you backtrace based on all the medical information that I've researched, and I'm a CFS patient for like 10 plus, and it's all been I've got cross reference from all the best doctors I could find. But anyway, when I research it, Epstein-Barr virus, I was up at Incline Village. I'm a skier and all that. And I was just wondering if you could reflect on the evolution of the Epstein-Barr virus. And now it's going into the Guillain-Barré virus. And I was wondering if you could reflect on that.
Richard. Guillain-Barré isn't caused by a virus. It's caused by by any number of viruses, including, I might add, flu vaccine, which was a dead flu. It wasn't even live flu. So just the antigens, the little proteins that they threw into a vaccine for swine flu actually got some people to get Guillain-Barré. So you can't really talk about a Guillain-Barré virus. I didn't know what you meant by genetically engineered. Do you think someone invented these things?
I think it's definitely look up emerging viruses, a book. You can look that up. But anyway, it was genetically engineered, and it has been. And are you willing to accept that some of these viruses are genetically engineered, or are you part of this process?
I am wanting to. I know a great deal about genetic engineering for a primary care physician because I've made a study of it in the recent years as we've developed some really frightening things, some of which I maybe will have time to share with the listening audience today. But I don't know. I guess I'm part of the conspiracy because I don't believe that EBV, CMV, or any of the other things that can be dug out of deepest, darkest Africa, and I don't believe these are genetically engineered. I don't think we can do that yet. We can do a lot, but I don't think we can really build a virus from scratch. And when you look at these viruses and you find them embedded in animals, you find them embedded in things that have been around for hundreds of years. When you check in the DNA, you find these viruses embedded in there. To me, that says that their presence predates our science. So that's a way of indirectly disproving the idea that these have been created by some, you know, mastermind lab somewhere that has dark technology that isn't been revealed to the rest of the scientific establishment. So, no, I guess I'm part of the enemy. I don't believe
it. Can I have one last question?
Sure.
So it's a matter of scientific fact, and you're into science just like me. Mm-hmm. I've studied the same study. But they actually literally sprayed Navy personnel with some of these biological agents, and it's a matter of scientific fact.
Okay, but so what? I mean, I'm not saying that was a good thing to do, but what does that prove?
Why did the U.S. Navy have to spray its own personnel with a biological agent, and yet even the U.S. U.S. sprayed even the civilian personnel with biological agents?
That's really a different question. It's kind of in terms of why the military does anything. I'm going to have to take the fifth on that one, but I don't believe that the track record of our military in terms of using soldiers as guinea pigs and trying out all kinds of things on them. I mean, what do you think Gulf War syndrome is? What do you think? What about dioxin? What about the effect of Agent Orange on the Vietnam vets? I mean, don't set me up to defend our military, because I'm with you that they do stuff they shouldn't be doing.
But that's my whole point, is where does any person have any kind of civil recourse, whether they're sprayed as a veteran, or even from what I can tell, studying civilian recourse, where do you have any kind of recourse for being sprayed? They did it in New York City.
Yeah. I feel that's more of a question for maybe a lawyer show or something like that. So, Richard, thank you. I'm going to sign off now, but I really appreciate your call, and you have some very provocative and interesting ideas. I hope that you are able to get some good assistance for your chronic fatigue. That can be a very, very difficult, difficult cross to bear. Have a good day. And let's take another email. This one from Rick in Monterey. I'm 63 years old and occasionally have trouble falling asleep, more often trouble staying asleep. Waking at 3:30 to 4, or even an hour after falling asleep, often I'm awake for an hour. Boy, it sounds kind of familiar. I'm sure a lot of people would nod their heads with Rick. I do long, slow, deep breathing, and I've been using melatonin, 3 milligrams, more regularly now because it helps me sleep more deeply, and it seems to keep me sleeping for longer periods. I read an article recently which warns of possible repercussions from taking melatonin over long periods of time. What are your views and findings? And the article that he's referring to is from the Huffington Post, and it's called The Dark Side of Melatonin. It's written by one of their regular contributors, I think. So I reviewed the article, and Rick, I think that it's very speculative and a little sensationalistic. There's really not much in that article to worry you. So let's address a couple of the flaws and missing links in the article. For one thing, it suggests that you can somehow become resistant to melatonin if you take it for long periods of time. And there's actually, in the alternative cancer literature, large numbers of cohorts of people taking melatonin 20 milligrams, which is a massive dose compared to what you need for sleep. And at that dose, the hormone acts as an anti-cancer agent, reportedly anyway, and there's some small study data that suggests that it's helpful. But the point is, if people taking 20 milligrams a day still sleep, then melatonin resistance is just not a thing. I want to point you to an interview that I did with Dr. Phyllis Z. Let's see, this was June 4th, 2016. So if you go to askdrdon.com and go to the archives, you can check out the June 4th, 2016 show. And this is a really good discussion of melatonin as well as other aspects of sleep hygiene. The timing for melatonin, according to Phyllis Z., the sleep researcher that I interviewed on that program, is you want to take a smaller dose, maybe 0.5 to 1 milligram. Some people take up to 2, but you take it 4 or 5 hours before you fall asleep. Dr. Z says melatonin is the dark hormone. So if you're trying to use it to get sleepy, take it when it gets dark with the assumption that you'd be going to sleep 3 or 4 hours after sundown. There's no evidence for tolerance with that, and melatonin is probably fairly helpful taken earlier. If you are trying to do something about that middle of the night waking up, a small amount of melatonin under the tongue at that 3:30 a.m. wake up could put you back to sleep, but you run the risk of resetting your body clock such that you better be able to sleep in. And if you don't, well, that could be a bit of a problem. So try taking the melatonin much, much earlier and keeping the dose around no higher than 2 milligrams, and I think you can use it long-term, Huffington Post notwithstanding. And we're going to go talk to Sally in Capitola. Hello, Sally.
Dr. Motika.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. I had a question about the subject you were speaking of just a moment ago. I had a question about the biological spray that they used, and I was wondering exactly what that does to a person.
Which biological spray were you referring to?
The one that they sprayed the servicemen with.
Well, there have been a number of those circumstances, and I'm not really sure which one Richard was referring to. So the ones that, let's see, as far as I can think, every single war, there have been instances of experimenting on the troops. And, of course, the Gulf War syndrome is, you know, one of the more egregious ones. We now think that it was the combination of vaccines that was given to the soldiers all at once, and they were loaded up with a whole bunch of vaccines, and some of these actually damaged their systems in a fairly global way and led to a chronic low-grade toxicity that became known as Gulf War syndrome. And a syndrome is a set of symptoms. There have been, in terms of spraying people with viruses, I'm not sure which instance Richard was talking about. I don't actually think it matters, because I stand by my opinion of experimenting on the troops being something that, in a time of war, you know, you take your best shot and you hope you get it right, I guess, is the is the mentality. Specifically, anytime anything is sprayed, you run into a couple of issues. I'll speak to those in general. One of which is, it's not just the thing that you're spraying, it's the thing that's holding the thing that you're spraying. So if you go into your fridge and pull out some salad dressing and you read the ingredients on the back, you're going to find that there's at least half a dozen chemical names in there that you're going to say, well, what is this? You know, shouldn't it just be oil and vinegar and some spicing? But you've got emulsifiers, you've got things that are supposed to act as anti-spoiling agents and, you know, flavorings as well. And many of those are artificial. So think about the L-bomb apple moth spraying that went on in this community a few years ago. The problem that I saw from in most of my patients was not from the L-bomb, it was from the surfactant, which is something that they sprayed to make it stick to the leaves and stay on the trees. And that surfactant really bothered a lot of people's lungs, and anyone with vulnerable respiratory tracts reacted to that. And unfortunately, the focus was on safety trials had been not on the dispersant and the surfactant. The focus had been on the LBAM, and they determined that was safe, but the problem was they stuck it on board with a bunch of unsafe stuff. So it's always difficult to figure out what caused the problem in the first place. Sometimes it takes a lot of investigation.
Yeah, so also, is one of the symptoms having excessive fatigue syndrome?
Excessive fatigue can definitely be a symptom of anything essentially that is using energy. And the immune system, when it's activated, uses a lot of energy. So when you talk about chronic fatigue, any kind of chronic infection, tuberculosis, we mentioned that earlier in the show, that will give you a lot of distress.
Yes, so if they gave you a lot of immunizations for this and that and the other all at one time when mm-hmm. you were in the hospital a couple of years ago, could that do that as well?
Yeah, it could. And part of the problem with immunizations, and, you know, immunizations is a real, oh gosh, it's a can of worms, all right? And I want to come down as someone who has seen tetanus kill somebody, and I don't agree that you don't vaccinate for tetanus, period, amen, because there are, those diseases are awful, and they kill you, and,
yep.
you know, the so we'll not dispute that infectious diseases are bad, I hope. What we will say is if we're going to use vaccinations, we want to use them as safely as possible. And giving them all at once is, I think, very wrong-headed. There's something in every vaccine called an adjuvant. And an adjuvant is an irritant. It's designed to irritate and annoy the immune system so that the immune system will go looking for trouble and find it in the form of the thing that you're trying to vaccinate for. So the immune system will think that the problem is not the adjuvant, but the diphtheria or the pertussis that we put in there next to the adjuvant. And so it'll make antibodies against the pertussis, which is exactly what we want. And so that's great, right? So you give enough irritant in a vaccine to irritate the immune system. Now, what happens when you give three or four vaccines, all of which were studied and developed to each one contain enough irritant to get the immune system riled up? And now you're giving four, five, maybe six times as much of that irritant into an individual, as well as a number of things that you expect them to make antibodies to. It's kind of nuts. And,
they did that to me. And my question was, is what do you recommend for the fatigue that you do suffer afterwards?
Well, if the fatigue has been persistent for more than 6 months, then you basically need a mitochondrial rescue plan. And you need to make sure that you haven't become more vulnerable to some of the normal toxins that exist in our environment. So, for example, surfers. I have a couple of surfers that if there's too much toxin locally sometimes in the ocean, and they'll get very sick because their bodies no longer can get rid of toxins as readily as they used to be able to. I mean, that's energy dependent. So when your energy, it's a kind of a catch-22. Your mitochondria stop working because of the immune system being overactive, that drains you of energy. Then you can no longer eliminate toxins that are present in the environment. So now the toxins actually injure the mitochondria further, and you end up having less and less energy. And that's a vicious cycle. So the first thing to do is probably go see a functional medicine person like myself or one of the other functional medicine docs in town. Get organic acid testing. Get your mitochondria looked at. Get a nutritional assessment to see whether or not you're lacking in critical nutrients that might be in you. You might need just more than the average person.
Yes.
And that's how we're going to figure out what you need to try and get your system back together. But typically what we end up doing is certain nutritional therapies. We often end up feeding people ribose and L-carnitine and lots of CoQ10. Sometimes we end up using antitoxins. Cholestyramine is an agent that will actually suck toxins out of the bowel. And if you've gotten exposed, like from the ocean or something like that, it can be a good detox. But if you're living in a moldy house, it's not going to do anything because the mold is omnipresent and you're getting a new toxic dose every day. And that's overwhelming your body at this point. So essentially what happens is an ordinary situation is that you get this blow, it takes you down, and you're able to come back. When people don't come back, then we have to ask why. What is it about them? and how can we support getting their normal, vibrant energy back? And sometimes it's a long row to hoe, and you have to figure out a lot of things that are going on. So you need to get professional help, and you should get, like I said, organic acid testing and maybe an assessment for whether there could be toxins in your environment that are helping perpetuate this.
Oh, well, thank you very much for your time, and it's been informative speaking to you today about what you recommended to me, so you take care.
Thanks a lot. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We are, in fact, out of time. We've come to the end of this hour, and thank you so much. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.